This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. Newslink.
Hello and welcome to Newslink. I'm John Doyle in Bonn. Coming up on the program, the last Eurozone holdout, Slovakia, approves expanding the EU bailout fund. But at what cost? Also on the program, why many say that Germany has too much to lose if the euro collapses.
We have a common market with one single currency and without any transaction costs. The export from Germany to France or to Slovakia is the same as an export from New York to Texas or to California.
And a new museum opens its doors in Italy dedicated to ancient musical instruments. We'll have those reports and much more coming up on Newslink. This is Newslink, and I'm John Doyle in Bonn. Slovakia's parliament has just approved expanding the EU bailout fund in a repeat of Tuesday's failed vote. Slovakia is the last of the 17 Eurozone nations to approve increasing the size and scope of the fund to a total of 440 billion euros. The fund is meant to boost Europe's defenses against market turmoil. Our Slovakia correspondent Rob Cameron is on the line. Rob, why the sudden change of mind?
Well, this sudden change of heart, I think, is really just down to party politics in Slovakia. Basically, by the time that lawmakers in Slovakia voted on Tuesday, the Prime Minister, the government, didn't have enough votes to pass both ratification of the Euro bailout fund and the vote of confidence that was tied to that vote in an effort to pressure one of the four parties in the coalition to back the bailout fund. So both motions failed. In the meantime, the left-wing opposition, who said all along, look, we support the bailout fund, what we don't support is this centre-right government. Now that the government has collapsed, the left-wing opposition were ready to support the bailout fund, which is why it passed so easily and quickly indeed on Thursday.
So the opposition essentially was voting against the government on Tuesday and not necessarily against the bailout.
Indeed, that's exactly right.
What's the mood in the country? Is there the feeling that national politics were played out at the cost of Europe?
I think there is. I think Slovaks are quite divided about it because it has to be said that there is really a lot of disillusionment in Slovakia about the euro, about bailing out countries that are richer than Slovakia. Don't forget, the average pension in Slovakia is about 400 euros. The average pension in Greece is about 1,400 euros. So quite a difference there. So why should fiscally responsible Slovaks who went through years of austerity measures of their own bail out a much richer country? There is a lot of unhappiness with the ratification, and there's also unhappiness indeed with the fact that domestic politics did embarrass Slovakia for several days.
Do you think that Slovakia felt pressured by the EU to vote again and vote differently on Thursday?
Of course. I think huge pressure was being exerted on the Slovaks, on Mrs. Radičová, the Prime Minister, who will continue to lead her country probably in an acting capacity until the early elections are held in March, which was the precondition for the Socialist Opposition Party in backing the bailout fund. There was a lot of pressure, but of course Slovakia was the last of the 17 Eurozone countries to vote to ratify this move. So obviously they did feel the heat, as it were, coming from Europe.
Okay, now maybe one last question. There have been calls within the European Commission to change the voting process, to not make it in the future unanimous. Do you think that there will be changes made, or do you think that we're going to be in a similar position in a different EU country in the future?
Well, I think it's hard to say, but I think certainly this week's events in Slovakia perfectly illustrates the pitfalls of having that unanimous voting system that the European Union and the Eurozone uses at the moment. And I think many people were asking, how is it possible that a country of 5.5 million people, a country that was only going to contribute 7.7 billion euros in guarantees to the Eurozone bailout fund, a tiny percentage of the total amount, that they could hold us hostage over this. But of course, that's Europe. That's the way it works.
And that was our Slovakia correspondent, Rob Cameron. Continuing now, Italy's Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi addressed Parliament as he and his ruling centre-right coalition brace for a confidence vote in Italy's Parliament on Friday. And as Deutsche Welle's Megan Williams reports from Rome, Mr. Berlusconi is desperately trying to shore up support as more and more signs emerge that his coalition is crumbling.
L'equiparazione.
If it weren't for the heavy bags under his eyes and his haggard looks, the Prime Minister's speech in Parliament was vintage Berlusconi, a mix of blaming the opposition, media and judges for Italy's problems and promises of wealth and reform if the country stuck by him.
Io sono qui e con me una maggioranza.
I am here with a cohesive political majority, apart from parliamentary accidents, to witness that Italy can win by beating the strategy of pessimism, said Berlusconi. But after almost a decade as prime minister, the billionaire leader's grip on power is hanging by a thread. The parliamentary accident Berlusconi referred to in his speech occurred earlier this week when his weakened coalition lost a key vote on the budget by one vote.
Dichiaro chiusa la votazione. La Camera respinge.
As the opposition cheered, a clearly furious Berlusconi shoved past his finance minister, Giulio Tremonti, who showed up too late to vote. Tensions between the two men is high as Tremonti has pushed for unpopular reforms while Berlusconi tries to cling to power. On a personal front, the leader faces four separate trials ranging from fraud to sex with a minor, and he risks even more charges linked to his now infamous Bunga Bunga sex parties. As a result of that and the economic crisis, his popularity is at an all-time low. Berlusconi's speech on Thursday was a rallying cry to his supporters before a key confidence vote in Parliament on Friday. The leader has promised he'll remain in power until elections in 2013, but as rifts in his own party deepen and once loyal backers openly distance themselves from him, economists and business leaders are pushing for Berlusconi to step down so an interim government can take over.
A social coalition could be a good solution for the problems that Italy has to manage in this moment.
Economic professor Gian Maria Grosspietro says because neither the opposition nor Berlusconi have been able to muster the support for major economic reform, a social or technical coalition is drawing more support.
What we need are measures that will be hard and will be by sure unpopular. That is why we need, from one side, a large coalition to support these measures, people from different parties and different constituencies. And also, in my opinion, it would be a good thing if the persons which will be involved in presenting and supporting and defending this maneuver and these measures would be persons which have not the intention to be candidate in the next elections, because they will have the responsibility of presenting and supporting very unpopular measures.
Measures that Italy needs to avert a recession, says Grosspietro. Megan Williams, Deutsche Welle Radio, Rome.
Deutsche Welle.
And Germany's leading economic institutes see storm clouds ahead for the global economy. In their annual fall forecast, which has just been made public in Berlin, they're predicting modest growth of 1.3% among industrialized countries and more dynamic growth in emerging countries in Asia and in Latin America. Global economic growth is expected to remain stable at 2.5% next year, but analysts say that there is still serious reason for concern, as Uwe Hessler reports from Berlin.
It's no secret that the Eurozone debt crisis is weighing heavily on national economies in Europe and beyond. So analysts from the five leading German economic research institutes believe that solutions must come quickly if a full-blown global recession is to be prevented. Oliver Holtemüller from the Halle Economic Research Institute says a first and decisive step towards that aim is relieving Greece of its huge debt burden. He warns, however, that the envisaged write-off of Greek debt, known as haircut, may have dangerous consequences for the European banking system.
We expect that there will be a haircut in Greece. And of course, this will have effects on the banking system. And we need mechanisms to overcome the situation, for example, by further market interventions by the ECB. We hope, at least, that it will be possible to take care of the situation and don't get a fully expanded global recession out of this scenario.
If the debt crisis were to cause another meltdown in the banking system, the Institute say their predictions for even modest economic growth would be obsolete. If, however, attempts to overcome the crisis succeed, economies may only suffer a limited damage. Nevertheless, Germany can expect a reduction in growth from 2.9% this year to 0.8% in 2012, while the global economy may remain stable at around 2.5% growth next year. Yet major short- and long-term reforms are urgently needed, says Holtemüller.
In the long run, it is important that we get a mechanism that also banks and countries may fail. We need insolvency plans for countries in the European Union. In the short run, it is important that we stabilize the situation. And that means also that the taxpayer, by giving money to the EFSF, for example, but also the central banks, stabilize the situation.
If the debt crisis spreads out of Greece to infect countries such as Spain and Italy, the economists believe that the 440 billion euro EFSF, or European Financial Stability Facility, will not be enough. But nobody can know what's going to happen then, the institutes admit. That is why bashing Europe's political leaders, notably German Chancellor Angela Merkel, isn't going to help either.
I think the situation is extremely difficult. So it is easy to criticize politics, right? But to be honest, nobody has the clear plan how to do it. Given the problems, I would not be too harsh. But, of course, there is further need for action.
The economists say that the upcoming Eurozone summit at the end of October is crucial. The plans to be worked out there for solving the debt crisis as well as shoring up the banking system need to be thoroughly convincing, they say. Otherwise, forecasts of any economic growth whatsoever will remain wishful thinking. Uwe Hessler, Deutsche Welle Radio, Berlin.
And when considering modest economic growth expected for Germany next year, and the fact that many feel that the country is already overcommitted financially when it comes to bailing out Greece, spending even more money on Europe is something that's deeply unpopular in this country. According to a recent poll, 80% of Germans say they're against any further bailouts. But, as Deutsche Welle's Stephen Beard reports, Germany may have little choice but to ante up once again, since the country has too much to lose if the euro collapses.
This pacemaker manufacturer must be having palpitations. The boss, Christoph Boehmer, is getting alarmed about the euro crisis because the currency has been great for his business.
We do the majority of our business in the eurozone, and with the euro, there's no currency risk in that eurozone. That's been of incredible help.
So you like the euro?
We absolutely do like the euro.
17 countries with a combined population bigger than the United States have adopted the euro. The currency has turned these countries into a giant playground for Germany's all-powerful exporters. Philipp Schlottberler is with the German Chambers of Commerce.
We have a common market with one single currency and without any transaction costs. The export from Germany to France or to Slovakia is the same as an export from New York to Texas or to California.
Since the euro was launched 12 years ago amid much festivity, German exporters have done extremely well out of it. And it's not just because of the lack of transaction costs in their biggest market. Their exports outside the eurozone have benefited too, because the European currency has been weaker than the old Deutschmark would have been. So Germany has kept its products priced competitively on the world market. This might explain why the Greek Prime Minister got a respectful and friendly reception when he visited Berlin recently. Here he is addressing a group of German business people.
I promise you, we Greeks will soon fight our way back to growth and prosperity after this period of pain.
If George Papandreou's audience had been made up of the German public, it might not have applauded. 80% opposed the transfer of any more money, especially to Greece. But political scientist Henrik Enderlein says business and political leaders in Germany now face a stark choice.
What's more costly, transfers to Greece and potentially other countries today, or accepting the costs of a failure of the euro area?
The costs of a euro collapse could be horrendous. The whole region could be plunged into turmoil, says German economist Katinka Barisch.
There would not be only a massive run on all European banks. There would be a collapse in exports. There would be a deep, deep recession.
Germany would be especially hard hit, its banks having lent an estimated $1.5 trillion to Greece, Spain, Portugal, Ireland and Italy. Those countries would struggle to repay their debts in their new devalued currencies. And, says Philipp Schlott-Berler, German exporters would struggle too.
The exchange rate of German currency would increase much higher than the euro, and that would make exports very difficult for German companies, of course.
The euro is part of a long process that started after the Second World War, a process of ensuring peace by integrating Germany into Europe, tying it down, forging powerful bonds between it and its neighbours. A euro collapse would shatter those relations. The euro crisis has already soured the European mood. Twelve years ago, when the euro was launched, a multinational choir sang Land of Hope and Glory outside the European Central Bank in Frankfurt. This now has a hollow ring. There doesn't seem much hope or glory in Euroland today. Stephen Beard, Deutsche Welle Radio, Berlin.
And now to a very different subject, and Maestro Luigi Fernando Tagliavini is an organist, a musicologist, and a collector of ancient instruments. His collection boasts, above all, an astonishing selection of pianos and other older keyboard instruments, such as clavichords and spinets. And last year, he donated his collection of about 70 musical instruments to a new museum that was created specially for them in San Colombano, just outside of Milan. And not only is the entry free, but the maestro also offers concerts at his museum, played, of course, by the maestro himself, as well as also by other musicians on antique instruments. Well, the maestro himself is never too far away, regularly visiting the collection to keep the instruments, as he puts it, in shape. He gave Danny Mitzmann a tour of his musical treasure trove.
Celebrating his 82nd birthday this week, the last thing Luigi Ferdinando Tagliavini is thinking about is retirement. A professional concert organist and harpsichordist, he's also an internationally renowned professor of music. An expert in antique instruments, his collection, which he began over 60 years ago, is the fruit of a lifetime's passion.
I come see this instrument 2 or 3 days in the week, except, of course, when I'm in trip. Tomorrow, for instance, I will be here again, because tomorrow is the day where our restaurator comes. And so I will guide him for restoring some instruments.
As a young music student, Luigi Ferdinando Tagliavini fell in love with several exquisitely crafted antique organs and harpsichords, but his vast collection actually has very humble beginnings.
The origin of my collection is very old. Begins with two instruments. The one belonging to my paternal grandmother, it's a mandolin, and the other belonging to my maternal grandfather, it's an accordion. They are very, very simple instruments, but they are instruments belonging to my family and belonging to the 19th century. One of the very first instruments, we will see it very soon, is a square piano built, well, not dated, not signed, but certainly built in Bologna at the beginning of the 19th century. We are here in the small hall of pianos and other keyboard instruments, and that instrument is just the first one I found. You see, it's a very nice instrument. Well, I found this piano probably at the end of the 40s, immediately after the war. There are more than 60 years.
The building's a combination of secluded rooms on different levels and sumptuous halls with ancient frescoes by the famous Bolognese Carracci school. It's the perfect location for a collection of treasures like this. As we pass from one instrument to the next, this eminent musicologist reveals his joyfully boyish spirit.
Everything which has to do with music is, playing music and playing with toys. And maybe two or three of the instruments you see here are, in a certain sense, toys. Look at this instrument. Has the aspect of a square piano, but it's a pianoforte a cristallo, a glass-coated piano. The sound is produced by these pieces of glass. Another toy is this one. That is a Scottish instrument built in Glasgow, also with a very special sound. The name is Dulcitun. The sound is produced by tuning forks, you know, just like the tuning fork you use for tune the instrument. Only, we don't have just only one tuning fork, but you have 61 tuning forks for every note. Unfortunately, almost always in museums, people have the idea that an old instrument has not to be touched. So you find beautiful instruments, but unplayable. But in the case of my instrument, I restitute to them the sound, the sonorous life. The tree is dead, but the wood lives still. And playing it, the vibrations, I think, help its life.
Luigi Ferdinando Tagliavini does have a favorite instrument. It's a beautifully crafted, exquisitely decorated harpsichord dating back 3 centuries. But he says he loves every one of the 70 pieces.
I feel them as a part of my family. Yes.
Maestro Tagliavini thought he might feel the absence of his family when they moved into their new home. But on the contrary, he says the museum now feels like a second home to him too. And he's a very happy man, knowing his collection can now be enjoyed by so many more people. Danny Mitzman, Deutsche Welle Radio, Bologna.
And you're listening to Newslink, and I'm John Doyle in Bonn. This is Newslink, and I'm John Doyle in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, rail bombs increase fears of left-wing attacks in Berlin.
The conservative liberal government of our republic wants to show that there is a big danger from left-wingers. I can't see it in the moment, but we can't be sure.
Also on the program, Germany's foreign minister on a trip to Turkey makes sure to steer clear of any thorny issues, and Icelandic storytelling at this year's Frankfurt Book Fair. We'll have those reports and much more. But first, the French Parliament has voted in favor of sending juvenile delinquents to so-called boot camps run by ex-military personnel. With that story from the French capital, Paris, here's Deutsche Welle's John Lawrence.
French soldiers on the march singing a song that French juvenile delinquents will doubtless be learning soon, because President Sarkozy wants to give young first-time offenders a taste of army discipline.
Diversifier la réponse pénale pour les mineurs, c'est aussi permettre que les auteurs de délits moins graves.
Diversifying the penal response for offenders under 18 years of age also means that those who commit less serious offences should be able to carry out a citizenship service inside a military-type establishment.
Dans le cadre d'un établissement d'insertion de la défense.
There has been a steep rise of youth crime over the past few years. It's the black spot in Sarkozy's law and order record. And at the moment, 53,000 minors who commit offences each year get off scot-free because there are no suitable structures where they could be reformed or at least kept from reoffending. From the start of next year, judges will be able to send youths of 16 or over to boot camps for spells of 6 to 12 months, where they will get professional training in the morning, sport in the afternoon, and military discipline all the time. Parliamentarian Eric Ciotti drew up the plan. It's not a miracle solution, Ciotti told BFM TV, but it is one more solution in the magistrate's toolbox for fighting against juvenile delinquency. Ciotti's idea is very close to one put forward by Sarkozy's socialist rival at the last presidential election, Ségolène Royal. For the record, Sarkozy said at the time that military training for delinquents was ridiculous. But many others on the left dislike the very idea of giving the military an educational role outside the armed services. Maryse Dumas, for example, a trade union leader with the communist-led CGT union.
L'armée, c'est tout le monde les deux doigts sur la couture du pantalon.
The army means everyone with two fingers on their trouser seam and obeying the chief, Dumas told RMC Radio. And I don't think that in a 21st century society, this is the right direction to take for democracy, for living together as a community, and for the future of these young people. Opinion polls show that most French people, however, like the boot camp idea. These people are more likely to be disappointed by the scale of the measure, as, in the short term at least, only 200 places will be available. John Lawrence, Deutsche Welle Radio, Paris.
And the Rhine River separates France and Germany, dividing both countries in more ways than one, however. On the French side, in Alsace, stands Fessenheim, the oldest and most controversial atomic power station in France. On the other side of the Rhine, only 1.5 kilometers away, slightly less than a mile, is the German state of Baden-Württemberg, where the anti-nuclear movement has been deeply entrenched for decades. Well, next month, the French government will be deciding whether or not to prolong the life of Fessenheim's reactors for another 10 years. But times are changing. Since Fukushima, French anti-nuclear activism is no longer a fringe movement in a country that has long championed nuclear energy. Diana Fang has this report from Fessenheim.
I am standing on the French side of the Chalampé-Neuenburg bridge that connects France to Germany. This region of Alsace has changed hands a number of times since 1648. Now hundreds of Germans are again approaching from the other side of the Rhine, but this time they are coming as allies. They're here to join a growing number of French anti-nuclear activists at a rally to stop Fessenheim. Anti-nuclear demonstrations have taken place here ever since the Fessenheim Atomic Power Station was built in the 1970s. But since Japan's Fukushima nuclear disaster in March, the protests have stepped up. There are men and women, young and old, Germans, French, and even the Swiss from the city of Basel, some 40 kilometres south of here. I ask people why they're against nuclear power.
Because it's dangerous. We could have an earthquake here. We saw that with Fukushima. We were against the construction of Fessenheim over 30 years ago, when other nuclear power stations had also been planned in the region. Only Fessenheim was built. It's still dangerous.
The issue is not just about nuclear power, but about Fessenheim in particular. This tiny village of over 2,000 people lies on a Rhine Valley rift that destroyed nearby Basel in an earthquake back in the Middle Ages. At the time Fessenheim was being built in the 1970s, plans for another atomic station in Wiel on the German side of the Rhine were scrapped due to massive opposition. In Germany, the anti-nuclear movement had already taken root long before the accidents at Three Mile Island in the US or Chernobyl in the former Soviet Union.
The problem with Fessenheim is if there ever is an accident, it will be no accident but a catastrophe.
Unlike Japan, where the radioactive fallout from the Fukushima Daiichi plant blew into the Pacific Ocean, Fessenheim is situated in the heart of Western Europe. The nuclear site's twin reactors, which were commissioned in the late 1970s, are the oldest in France. And critics say age is only one of Fessenheim's problems. Claude Maillet is on the board of the anti-nuclear lobby Stop Fessenheim.
On le sait, donc l'Alsace est sur une zone sismique.
For one, Alsace is already in an area of seismic activity. On top of that, the nuclear plant was built below the water level of the Grand Canal of Alsace. So if an earthquake were to break the dam, the reactors and safety pumps could be damaged by floods.
Rupture, disons, des pompes et refroidissement. Donc voilà.
Echoes of Fukushima, in other words.
If we have a Basel earthquake direct under Fessenheim, Fessenheim will break. But that's only one thing. Fessenheim is not safe, but we say all atomic power stations all over the world are not safe.
That's Axel Meyer, head of the Freiburg section of the environmental group BUND, the German chapter of Friends of the Earth. Meyer argues that even the most vigilant safeguards cannot protect against human error, sabotage, or the unpredictable forces of nature.
We had the Chernobyl accident, and all the experts said Chernobyl accident is never possible in Germany and in France. We had Fukushima, and now the experts say Fukushima accident is not possible in Germany and in France. But that's not the problem. The problem is we don't know what kind of accident we have for the next accident. Maybe we have a terrorist act against atomic power station. Maybe we have an earthquake. There are so many different things which can happen. And if we have this accident, it's a kind of accident we can't believe.
The atomic power station is the main industry of Fessenheim. It employs 700 people in the area and provides the city council half of its revenues. I spoke to Madame Le Maire, Fessenheim Mayor Fabienne Stich, who is prepared in the unlikely event of a nuclear accident.
Le risque zéro n'existe pas, on l'a vu.
There is no such thing as zero risk, but if anything were to happen, we know what to do. We conduct emergency practice drills in schools, and every family in the village is equipped with a supply of iodine tablets should the worst happen. The reactors are technically sound, so I can only hope that Fessenheim won't be sacrificed in the run-up to the presidential elections.
Au moment des élections présidentielles.
The French elections will be next spring, so the pressure to shut down Fessenheim, a political liability, is mounting. Diana Fong, Deutsche Welle Radio, in Fessenheim, France.
And moving on now, police in Berlin have once again found a potential firebomb beside train tracks in the south of the capital. So far, firebombs have been found in 9 locations around the city since Monday. No one has been hurt, but hundreds of trains have been delayed, causing what many are calling rail chaos in the German capital. Well, I spoke earlier with political scientist and journalist Martin Jander in Berlin and asked him first what we know about the group that's behind the attacks.
There has been a similar incident some weeks ago, and maybe that is the same group, but we do not know that exactly. What we know that there is a testimonial in the internet, and they give a short explanation of why they did these things they do. For me, it seems it's a bit a weird ideology, a mixture out of anti-capitalism, anti-militarism, anti-globalism and such things. So we do not know so much about these people. But, well, we know there were 15 attempts to attack tracks. That's a lot. So it must be a group, not very big, but bigger than two people or three people. That's all we know.
Okay, now German politicians, as you're aware, have been talking about the possibility of this being the start of a new wave of left-wing terrorism here in Germany. Do you subscribe to this?
Not really. One thing is clear, that when Andreas Baader and Gudrun Enslin started the RAF, they started with attacks like this, not on tracks of Bundesbahn and S-Bahn, but they were burning a warehouse in Frankfurt. This was in the year 1968, so they thought, and that's the same thing as this group thinks, they could, let's say, attack things, but not human beings. Later on, it came out that they were not only attacking things or houses or tracks, they were attacking human beings. Maybe that could be the same thing with this group, though this group says they do not want to attack human beings. They just want to attack things.
Okay, now the police in Berlin are talking about this as possibly being the beginning of a new wave of left-wing terror. The Interior Ministry supports this idea, it seems, to a certain extent. The Social Democrats, however, say that this is an exaggeration of the situation in Berlin. Is this politics we're seeing played out here, or are there very different views of what's going on?
I think it's a bit politics. In the moment, we can't see left-wingers really forcing or developing a policy of terrorism. What we see instead is that maybe you know that beginning with October 1990, we have 150 people that were killed by right-wingers, by fascists. We do not have the same thing on the left-wing side. So I think now defining these incidents in Berlin as terrorism is politics. The conservative liberal government of our republic wants to show that there is a big danger from left-wingers. I can't see it in the moment, but we can't be sure. Andreas Baader and Gudrun Enslin started in the same way.
Okay, one last question. Extreme left-wing groups in Berlin in the past have been known for setting expensive cars on fire, for throwing petrol bombs into banks' windows. Can we see this possibly as an escalation of the violence, these recent arson attacks?
I'm not sure. I'm not a prophet. But what it takes to do such a terrorist politics is a logistic structure. And in the moment, I can't see any logistic structure here done by Berlin left-wingers. Police, as far as I know, does not see that. So I hope there is not a beginning of a new terrorist politics.
And that was political scientist and journalist Martin Jander in Berlin. For 30 years now, Turkey has been gripped by a guerrilla war waged by the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party. Those guerrillas, who demand greater autonomy for the Kurdish minority, finance themselves with so-called taxes on local businesses. And as Deutsche Welle's Rhys Ehrlich reports from Diyarbakir, Turkey, some of the businesses pay voluntarily, but many do not.
The Naren brothers own a restaurant that specializes in panini-style sandwiches. Nimet Naren demonstrates how he prepares the specialty of the house.
We have a full mixed sandwich. Eggs, cheese, egg with sausages.
In the early 1990s, Naren's father owned a local hotel. At that time, the Turkish government was cracking down on the PKK, which was conducting guerrilla raids in southeastern Turkey. Nimet's brother, Mahmoud, says he and his brother were apolitical, but their sister had joined the guerrillas.
The army officer said, if something happens to one of my soldiers, I will burn this hotel. It was an angry threat. I was only 20. We weren't involved politically. We didn't know anything.
Nimet says a few days later, the army officer made good on his threat.
The Turkish army burned 24 shops and 21 cars. They burned our shop and our hotel. My father was burned alive.
Such horrific repression in years past turned many otherwise non-political Kurds into PKK sympathizers. The guerrillas levy what they call taxes on businesses in order to support their cause. Some pay voluntarily, although they don't talk about it publicly. But other business people remain adamantly opposed to the PKK. In an office away from downtown Diyarbakir, Seamus Abbas explains that he owns construction and textile businesses. He says he's never been approached by the PKK tax man, but does have friends who were.
They come to your place and they say you have to give them some part of your profit. You know who they are. Besides money, they also want to scare people and make them run away from this region.
Abbas says the PKK wants to intimidate opponents. The PKK once favored socialism and independence for Kurdistan, but now mostly fights for its own power, according to Abbas. He explains what happens to even prominent businessmen who don't pay up.
The PKK asks for money, but he doesn't pay. Or perhaps he gives an interview on TV criticizing them. Perhaps he's doing business with the government. Either way, his equipment is burned. They want to punish anyone who doesn't think like them. You must be like them, or they don't give you the right to live.
Vahap Koskun, a law professor at a local university, says business people are caught between two powerful forces, the guerrillas and the repressive military.
If they don't pay, they can attack their workplace and equipment. They can burn it down. If they help the PKK, then they get punished by the military. If they don't help the PKK, they get hurt by them. There are two authorities in the region. Both want absolute power. People in the region are stuck between two fires.
The Turkish military is currently bombing PKK guerrilla bases in the mountains of nearby Iraqi Kurdistan. They've announced plans to send in ground troops as well. As long as the military conflict continues, Kurdish business people say they are likely to remain caught between two implacable foes. For Radio Deutsche Welle, I'm Reese Erlich, Diyarbakir, Turkey.
And staying in Turkey, and the German Foreign Minister Guido Westerwelle is visiting Istanbul. And his visit comes a day after the EU published a critical report on Turkey's progress to join its ranks. The key criticism was Ankara's increasingly belligerent stance towards EU member Cyprus. But as Dorian Jones now reports from Istanbul, the German foreign minister was keen to avoid the controversy and focus on strengthening bilateral relations.
The EU's annual progress report on Turkey's membership bid cast a shadow over the German foreign minister Guido Westerwelle's visit. The report strongly criticized Ankara for its increasingly hard line towards EU member Cyprus. Last month, Ankara dispatched warships to the island in an ongoing dispute over gas exploration. At a press conference with his German counterpart, Ahmet Davutoğlu, made clear Ankara's displeasure over the criticism. We see there is a one-sided perspective in EU when it comes to Turkey's international work, primarily on the Cyprus issue, and we feel seriously disturbed by this, he said, adding, we want the EU and primarily Germany to give a strong message to the Greek Cypriot side. This is of utmost importance for us. But the German foreign minister carefully avoided the controversy. He only warned that Turkey's EU membership will be a long process. His senior coalition partner is opposed to Turkey's membership. But Vestavella praised Ankara for its reform process, in particular for removing the army from politics. The balance between civilian government and the military has been readjusted. This has great significance for the constitutional process, he said. Vestavella also stressed Germany's support of Ankara in its fight against the Kurdish rebel group, the PKK. He also said that they were working on the thorny issue of easing EU visa requirements on Turks. That move is seen as key to promoting trade between Turkey and the EU. Turkey, with one of the fastest growing economies in the world, is being increasingly courted by European countries, and trade is a key element of Vestavella's visit. Vestavella also was keen to stress the importance of Turkey in developing democracies of the Arab Spring. There is no doubt that Turkey is a bridge builder and that we want to take advantage of this together. And that's why I'm glad that relations between our countries are so good, he said. That also has to do with the uprisings in the Arab world, where Turkey can and wants to play a key role.
Spielen kann und auch spielen will.
Ankara increasingly sees itself as a regional power with global aspirations. But such largesse could prove a double-edged sword to Europe. Former Turkish diplomat Sinan Ülgen warned Ankara is ready to end its membership bid over Cyprus.
The fact that the EU has lost its appeal and the Turkish government has lost its zeal with regard to EU accession changes the framework for the Turkish government.
Ankara is now warning not only Germany but the whole of the EU that it's ready for a final showdown, not only over Cyprus, but its stalled membership bid. Dorian Jones, Deutsche Welle Radio, Istanbul.
The German football player Thomas Hitzlsperger is among this year's winners of the Julius Hirsch Prize, which is awarded by the German Football Association to people or organizations that help to oppose anti-Semitism and to promote tolerance on the soccer pitch. The 29-year-old Wolfsburg midfielder was given the honorary award with a youth organization in the western town of Wiesbaden called Spiegelbild, or Mirror Image in English, winning the main prize. Deutsche Welle's Mark Hallam has the story.
Thomas Hitzlsperger has successfully rekindled a faltering football career over the past 18 months and has now been rewarded for his off-pitch activities. Once a member of Joachim Löw's Germany team, Hitzlsperger now plies his trade in the footballing province of Wolfsburg. The winner of the honorary Julius Hirsch Award for 2011 says his early career laid the foundations for this prize.
The idea came from my time as a player, because I went abroad at a young age. I became accustomed to the feeling of being a foreigner, of finding your way through a strange country, and seeking to debunk some of the stereotypes.
Hitzlsperger went to England as a teenager and cut his teeth with the Birmingham-based Aston Villa side. Since then, he has played in Germany, Italy, England again, and now Germany once more. Nicknamed the Hammer because of his heavy-hitting left-footed shot, Hitzlsperger won this accolade for his work as the author of the online website Störungsmelder, where fans are invited to report incidents of racism in the stands. The site's motto is, "We need to talk about Nazis." The president of the German Football Association, Theodor Zwanziger, praised the 29-year-old as a role model.
It's the way he lives. He delivers top performances for his club. He's an international player, a great footballer, but he's also able to use this role to offer social guidance.
61 different projects had applied for recognition in this year's Julius Hirsch Awards, with an organisation in the western city of Wiesbaden winning the first prize. Spiegelbild, or mirror image in English, seeks to honour German-Jewish history in the city, as member Hendrik Hartmann explains.
Juden nicht nur als Opfer zeigt, sondern als Tätige, als Aktive.
We don't just show Jews as victims, but as active members of society in the 1920s, when football was establishing itself as a sport and Jews were a part of it, a natural part of it, just like in other areas of society.
Second prize went to a cooperative of 9 soccer clubs in and around the Bavarian town of Grafenberg that have launched various actions to help stop neo-Nazis' march there. Theod Zwanziger from the German FA believes that sport owes it to the community to get involved in initiatives like these.
Der Kampf gegen rechtsradikale Tendenzen, gegen Rassismus im Besonderen.
The fight against far-right tendencies, against racism in particular, is a continual task. It's an area where the German FA must make credible efforts to ensure that such things never happen again, if at all possible.
The Julius Hirsch Prize has now been awarded 7 times. It was established in memory of former German international Julius Hirsch, a talented Jewish player who was murdered in the Auschwitz-Birkenau concentration camp in 1943. Mark Hallam, Deutsche Welle Radio.
And finally, 7,500 publishers from all over the world are currently presenting their books at the renowned Frankfurt Book Fair. The guest of honor this year is Iceland. And in Iceland, if things haven't been written down on paper, well, they never happened, at least according to the country's president. Deutsche Welle's Dagmar Breitenbach has more on Icelandic storytelling.
Breathtaking landscapes, sparse and lonely, Iceland has just the right settings to dream up stories. Not surprisingly, reading and literature have a long tradition in the country, dating back to the Icelandic sagas of the Middle Ages. Former President Vigdís Finnbogadottir, who is representing her country at the Frankfurt Book Fair, says that, in fact, in Iceland, nothing is as important as the written and spoken word.
We live in a very barren country. The Icelanders are very artistically minded and very creative, but they didn't have the material in the country to mold sculptures or to paint paintings in other countries, because we have no trees and lava is not strong enough for building a castle or whatever. Our castles are in the sagas.
Iceland can even boast a literature Nobel Prize laureate, Halldór Laxness, 56 years ago. About 40 Icelandic authors are presenting at the 2011 Frankfurt Book Fair, among them internationally renowned crime writers. Another successful writer is Andri Snær Magnason. His nonfiction bestseller questions the belief in perpetual economic growth. Dreamland, a self-help manual for a frightened nation.
You would write an article in a newspaper, but when you write a book, 200-300 pages, you can take the reader through a new thinking process. You can almost like try to reinstall a new program in their brain.
Magnason's book even formed the basis of a 2009 documentary that examined politics, environmental preservation, and corporate power taking over small communities in Iceland. At the other end of the literary spectrum, there's Gudrun Eva Minervudottir. She prefers to avoid political critiques. Her most recent novel, The Creator, is about loneliness and dependency issues.
I don't think I write specifically for the Icelandic reader. I'm not sure if my books are typically Icelandic or if I want them to be. I want to take part in the international dialogue somehow, if we think of literature like dialogue.
Literature as a dialogue of nations. Almost 200 Icelandic books were translated into German in time for the book fair, and quite a few of them are now being translated into English. It seems Iceland has been discovered as a country of storytellers. Dagmar Breitenbach, Deutsche Welle Radio.
And that's it for this edition of Newslink. I'm John Doyle saying thanks for listening, and goodbye from Bonn, Germany.
The world's biggest book fair, the Frankfurt Book Fair, is taking place this month. Every year, the show throws the spotlight on one country with special readings and events. Who is it this time? Is it A, Canada, B, Iceland, or C, Vietnam? Ooh, can't say no to hope. send your answers to quiz.english@dw-world.de. Letters and postcards should be sent to Deutsche Welle, English Service 53110, Bonn, Germany. You have until the end of the month to send in your answers. Good luck!
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the program. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.